Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. When an unexpected medical crisis sends Naomi Wolf, author of the classic The Beauty Myth, on a deeply personal journey to tease out the intersections between sexuality and creativity, she discovers, much to her own astonishment, an increasing body of scientific evidence that suggests that the vagina is not merely flesh, but an intrinsic component of the female brain, and thus has a fundamental connection to female consciousness itself. Her latest book, Vagina, A New Biography, draws on this set of insights about the mind-vagina connection to reveal new information about what women really need and considers what a sexual relationship and a relationship to the self transformed by these insights could look like. The Beauty Myth, her first book, was an international bestseller. Naomi Wolf followed that with Fire with Fire, The New Female Power and How It Will Change the 21st Century, Promiscuities, The Secret Struggle for Womanhood, and Misconceptions. It is a great pleasure to welcome Naomi Wolf to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Give us a sense of what brought you to, in your mind, a necessity for there to be a biography, and as it is worded on the title, a new biography.
Well, it's a little awkward to talk about, but it's an important part of what the truth is about what led me to research this science. I was always interested in, as a feminist and as a cultural critic, in why female sexuality is always targeted in culture after culture in all kinds of ways. And it never completely made sense to me. My questions kind of reached a turning point when I had a medical issue. I was born with a variant of spina bifida, which I never knew about, didn't bother me, but I had a spinal injury, and I was having some symptoms of loss of sensation in the pelvic area. And what was extraordinary to me was that when that was treated and when my spine was kind of replaced into alignment, I didn't just regain lost physical pleasure. This is hard to talk about, lost sexual pleasure. But I also regained states of mind that I had lost as well temporarily when I was having this symptom. A sense of confidence, of sort of exuberance, of sensing the connections between things. And so when I recovered after surgery, I was aware that there was something extraordinary that was undocumented to me about the brain-vagina connection. And by the way, I applaud you for saying that, you know, so straightforwardly and without giggling, because I'm still getting used to it. And then the scientists and physicians that I spoke with directed me to additional research that was absolutely extraordinary, because it showed me that there's a great deal of new data that's not been well reported in the mainstream media that in fact confirms that there is a brain-vagina connection, and that the things that I was experiencing have good physiological explanations. There's new data showing that there's a dopamine loop and an oxytocin and opioids loop, such that when a woman thinks about, anticipates, sort of strategizes toward, and we know we do this, good sexual pleasure, it boosts dopamine in her brain. And dopamine is responsible for mind states like confidence and risk-taking and goal orientation, motivation. When she has an orgasm, it boosts opioids. This is about the sense of bliss, ecstasy, transcendence. And also in orgasm, she gets a boost of oxytocin, which is about connection, trust, intimacy, bonding. So when I realized that, as well as other extraordinary data that these pioneers in neuroscience are establishing about the brain-vagina connection, it actually answered a lot of questions I've always had about patriarchy, because if the vagina mediates these very positive mind states for women, then of course it makes sense that for 5,000 years the vagina and female sexuality have been targeted. But there were other incredible headlines. You know, anatomists have found, for instance, the language is horrible, but it's all we've got, a new neural arm, they call it, between the clitoris and the G-spot. You know, we're sort of raised to think of these as different parts of ourselves, but in fact there's this new sexual organ that anatomists have found, such that the clitoris is the north and the G-spot is the south. And this is quite extraordinary because 30% of women in America self-report low libido. They're not getting pleasure from sex the way they want to. 30% report that they don't always have orgasms when they want to in lovemaking. And yet over 90% of women in lab conditions with strangers reached orgasm when both of these points of the same neural arm were stimulated at the same time. There are so many other extraordinary findings. I mean, there's a chapter on the new neuroscience about how rape, for instance, stays in the brain, stays in the body with clusters of symptoms that aren't obviously related to the sexual assault that could be years before. You know, all kinds of extraordinary new data that basically make our conventional wisdom about female sexual response obsolete. Most of our thinking about female sexual response kind of dates from Masters and Johnson in the 70s. And they sort of mapped female sexual cycle, which is quite similar to a male sexual cycle. But in fact, the new data show that women are quite different and very, very complex. And so, you know, I could go on and on about these new findings, but the brain-vagina connection is sort of the headline, you know.
A couple of follow-ups, and the initial one being of saying you're still grappling with actually saying the word and
yeah.
talking about it.
Boy.
In working on a book like this, was it something that you had to overcome to realize that—
I'm still overcoming it. It's not easy to this
So what is it? What does it say? Because, I mean, if this is happening to you, imagine what's happening to the rest of us at this point.
What do you mean by what's happening?
Meaning, as a feminist and as someone who has spoken out over the years on many issues in regards to women— that for you to have difficulty in talking about this in an open forum indicates to me that we all have a lot of difficulty talking about this in an open
you
forum.
You could not be more right. I mean, I'm really experiencing that right now. I knew that this subject was taboo on a lot of levels, and that's why it was important for me to call the book Vagina, because people could say, well, that's a confrontational title, but I'm very inspired by the gay rights movement. And similarly, gay and lesbian people's sexuality was sort of marginalized and targeted. They were asked to be ashamed of their sexuality. And then at a certain point in the 70s, gay and lesbian people said, we're not going to run from this. We're going to reclaim this language. We're going to say queer. We're going to redefine the word. We're not going to run. And that changed everything. And I also saw growing up in San Francisco, in the heart of the gay rights movement, that refusal to be shamed by their sexual identity was not just about who's sleeping with whom or, you know, what are people's genitals up to. It's about something much bigger. And so that's my model. But yeah, you know, I am taking a stand, if you like, for the vagina. It is very difficult because of 5,000 years of shame and silencing. I'm certainly getting plenty of reactions across the spectrum, both from people who are not comfortable with my intention of looking at female arousal and desire and orgasm on its own terms, as one supportive reviewer put it, rather than the way porn dictates or the way political correctness dictates. But, you know, I think many of us have difficulty, and that's all the more reason we need to talk about it. We're living in a culture, Joe, in which sexual information is everywhere. It's a hyper-sexualized culture in a way. Pornography is like wallpaper. But 30% of women are not getting the pleasure or satisfaction that they are made for by nature, by evolution. So the sexual revolution isn't working well enough for women. And so for their sakes and for the sakes of the readers who are talking to me about how this book has insights about their own anatomy and their own sexual response and their own consciousness that they didn't realize, I think it's really important to sort of power through and keep having this discussion.
And that figure of 30% I find interesting because just looking at your story, as you told it from the very beginning of having this medical condition that you were unaware of, how aware were you of what you were missing?
Oh, well, let me not overstate the crisis. I grew up in a very sex-positive environment, and I've always liked pleasure. That wasn't my concern. What's really more amazing to me is that even though I'm a feminist who studied sexuality for 23 years, you know, my whole career, there's information in this book that I didn't know and that readers are saying they didn't know about their own actual anatomy, actual sexual responses. For instance, I didn't know I even had a pelvic nerve. And it turns out that that is so fundamental to female response patterns. Let me give you just one example of the kinds of things that readers are saying, oh my God, I had no idea. And I too had no idea. I mentioned that Masters and Johnson, which is where our thinking about sex for men and women is kind of stuck, you know, for those of us who don't know this latest neuroscience, and very few people do, you know, they said, well, men and women have a similar cycle, arousal, plateau, climax, resolution. But the new neuroscience shows that women and men are very different. One example is, if you look at this incredible Netter image, and that's a medical illustration of the male pelvic innervation, and this is all big language, but it means the nerves in the male pelvis that go to sexual pleasure, and they come out of the spine. They're pretty regular. You know, I'm sure men are all very different. They have different fantasies and different childhoods and so on. But the things that make men happy physically are pretty straightforward. And if you look at the nerves around the penis, it's a kind of almost regularized grid. But then if you look at the Netter image, and again, I had no idea of the female pelvic innervation, it shows this beautiful tangle of nerves that's very, very complex throughout the female pelvis and reproductive system, so that there's a tangle of, it's called neural termini, a tangle of nerves at the mouth of the cervix. Barry Komisarek at Rutgers has actually found a new sexual center for women at the mouth of the cervix. There's innervation, there's neural termini, nerves terminating in the walls of the vagina. There's the one we're all familiar with, which terminates in the clitoris. But women have neural termini in the anus and the perineum, you know, throughout this their pelvic sort of spaces. And what's amazing to me, and I didn't know until Dr. Jeffrey Cole, the pelvic nerve guy of New York City, explained it to me, is that every woman is different and highly individual, highly subjective. Some women have more neural termini in the clitoris, some more in the perineum, you know, which explain, women have so many judgments about their sexual response. And they'll think, well, why am I not like his last girlfriend? Or why can't I just do this quicker? Or, you know, why do I like this? Is there something wrong with me? It could be culture, but it could also simply be the incredible variations in our very complex neural wiring.
I think that's what's so striking about the book, is how you are able to really find your way through these many complexities. And it is at its heart a book of science, and yet you bring these very important cultural and psychological thoughts to the subject as well. Was that a balance in the writing of it not being too science heavy and still making those connections so that the reader, male or female, would be able to take away how it could ultimately affect them?
Well, thank you, Joe, so much for noticing that. It's definitely a goal in the way I try to write, because frankly, these scientific abstracts I had to plow through are really, really, really dense. And
yeah, God love you for that.
Thank you very much.
I don't know how you make that.
They are intense. So it's very important. And I certainly, you know, I saw it too, and readers are telling me, you know, that I did a good job, thankfully, explaining how a certain, you know, study actually plays out in their daily lives. So let me give you an example. A lot of the new science shows that men's sexual responses are not that connected to their autonomic nervous systems. And what's the autonomic nervous system? It's about respiration and heart rate and blood flow, but that women's arousal is incredibly closely linked to the autonomic nervous system. So I'll tell you what it means in scientific terms. It means that a woman has to be free of what Dr. Jim Faust at Concordia University calls bad stress in order to be able to really get aroused, not just superficially, but on a very, very deep level. I never used to think about quote-unquote activation as a measure of arousal, but it's all about activation of the autonomic nervous system, I've discovered, meaning that women have to – it's not like this male model of, like, just go for it and have an orgasm. I mean, no disrespect to men. Women have to be free of bad stress. They then have to be so relaxed that their heart rate can elevate, you know, their respiration can quicken. They can start to have engorgement of vaginal tissues, erection of the clitoris, lubrication of the vaginal walls. And you know, all of these changes in their bodies, right, depend on relaxation. So this, so many readers are saying, oh my God, now I know I'm not crazy that I can't make love until the house is clean. Or I'm not crazy that, you know, if my partner left the socks on the floor and this is stressful for me, I can't just switch it off and switch on the sex thing. It turns out that the vagina, if you like, is kind of a barometer for women of when they feel safe and when they feel respected, because their highest arousal really can only come when they're free of bad stress and when they feel respected and valued by their partners, when these quote-unquote trivial things of maybe a partner snapping at them in the last 24 hours or disrespecting them, you know, that is a that directly goes to their arousal levels. It's not trivial. And that's quite amazing. You know, men who have read the book, and I don't mean it to just be, you know, valuable to heterosexual couples, lesbians and bisexuals also are sort of trying the things that, you know, the data show are worth trying in the book and finding an amazing change in their relationships, knowing how important feeling safe and valued and not stressing out is to women when they want to have really deep orgasms is really transformative. And I would say as a feminist, that's not a trivial thing. I'm being criticized right now but from some quarters for caring about female sexual pleasure. But if you look at how central my book shows female sexual pleasure is to female creativity and confidence and well-being, it is not trivial at all for women and their partners to know how to make them feel good, how to make them feel relaxed.
One of the things that I found striking is because of the complexity of what it takes for it to be right, of how much can go wrong.
Yeah.
The odds aren't with you, are they?
Right. Well, they're more with you if you know what's going on.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's why this information is so interesting.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And many, you know, I'm glad to say that many male readers have said that. You know, a lot of men who are writing to me are saying, you know, you really can't learn about women and their sexual responses from a porn culture or from the guys in the locker room. You really don't learn that much that's useful. And so, you know, just knowing that what worked the last time with, the, you know, the last woman isn't necessarily going to work with this one, and that you need to understand the anatomy and have what Mike Luzzatto, this quite effective tantric guru I interviewed, called patience and compassion if you're a man with a woman. You know, that's helpful. But also knowing, you know, the other things that I've got this amazing chapter, it's amazing to me anyway, where I looked at this, these incredible outcomes that these tantra gurus were having with women who had been not orgasmic or had had sexual trauma or, you know, weren't having the kind of sexual experiences that they wanted. And these tantra gurus were having extremely positive outcomes for those women. And I looked at what they were doing and mapped it up against neuroscience. And this is very useful for anyone who wants to be a lover of women. Just one example, you know, we trivialize courtship, dancing with a woman or bringing her flowers or dimming the lights. You know, we, in our culture, we sort of think, well, that's fine for the, you know, dating period. But when you're in a marriage or whatever, you've got her, you don't need to do that anymore. Well, that, the new neuroscience should show that that is a big mistake. That actually there are all kinds of things that seem like courtship rituals that women's neurobiology continue to need. For example, a study that Dr. Beverly Whipple did showed that when women are stimulated to orgasm in a kind of brightly lit clinical environment, there is actually something called a vaginal pulsometer. I can't believe I'm saying that on the radio, that measures the intensity of contractions. But that, you know, in a brightly lit sterile environment, they reach a certain level with that. But then the same subjects in a dark, comfortable, relaxing setting, the vaginal pulsometer quadruples in microvolts is actually how they measure it. So, you know, a lot of women in longstanding marriages say, you know, he doesn't court me anymore. He doesn't take me dancing. He doesn't bring me flowers. He doesn't try to seduce me. And things like, you know, making a beautiful environment, maybe turning down the lights, you know, the role of hugging or dancing and the neuroscience of, you know, what that does for women in terms of exposure to actually to pheromones in male sweat, but that's another subject. You know, things like bringing women flowers, you know, these are like measurably effective in creating a positive environment for a woman's autonomic nervous system response and for her sort of sexual well-being generally, as well as not snapping at her, stroking her. I mean, here's one. These seem so small, but they're so important. Women's bodies respond to stroking, non-sexual stroking, differently from men's bodies. So if you stroke a woman for 10 minutes, studies show she releases 10% more oxytocin. Men like it fine, but it doesn't have the same effect chemically on them or hormonally. So after 10 minutes of stroking, she's going to like you 10% more, feel closer to you, more trusting. Couples counselors who are using the findings in that section of the book are finding that women who are open to it, who are being stroked by their male partners or female partners, find that they can have difficult conversations at that time that they couldn't have before, or just that they feel so much closer, the relationship is so much smoother, friction about little things isn't as derailing, and then, of course, the lovemaking is more positive, you know, just from that one little change. So that's valuable. You know, that may not seem like an earth-shattering insight, but couples are finding it very, very helpful.
And exactly. It's couples who are finding that valuable in the sense that I would think that that information is just as important to the man or to the other woman in the relationship, that they get something out of that as well. It may not be as complex, but it still makes for a more positive experience.
Totally. You are 100% right, Joe. Men seem to understand the value of this right away, but sometimes women who are interviewing me have asked, well, don't men say what's in it for them? And overwhelmingly, I haven't had that response. I think any man or any heterosexual man who lives with a woman, overwhelmingly, most of them want those women to be happy, and they would like to know how to make them happy.
Right.
And so knowing that if you cuddle a woman or take her dancing, it affects her biology in positive ways, or even things like women are starved of being gazed at, looked into their eyes by their partners. It doesn't matter so much for men. Men are very happy to stand side by side and not engage in deep eye contact with each other. But women really need that eye contact. So, you know, for a man to know that if at the end of the day, a busy day, stressed out couples, you know, men are saying, well, okay, I put down my BlackBerry and for 10 minutes I'm just looking at my partner while she's talking to me, and that is making such a difference in how happy she is and how connected we feel to each other. You know, a lot of men really, really value that, and it comes back to them. I mean, here's a radical thing. The tantric sort of masters, if you like, that I interviewed, and again, I mapped out all of their findings against Western neuroscience because I'm skeptical. They said something that sounds very counterintuitive in our culture. They said the man should hold the woman's energy the way a wine glass holds wine. And this sounded really mystical and weird to me, and I didn't understand it. But then they said in a sexual interaction, the woman should be at the center of everything. The woman's pacing, the woman's needs should be at the center. This seems really counterintuitive in our culture, where it's about like competitive sex and pornographic sex and kind of, you know, racing to the finish and so on. But the more I studied what groups had really positive outcomes for men and women, the more convinced I was that, you know, they're onto something, because, you know, women take 16 minutes to reach orgasm and men take 4 on average. So it turns out that when a man, and we're talking about heterosexual couples, puts a woman's pacing and responses at the center of what's happening and doesn't rush her and lets her receive, that does all kinds of things to her ability to be highly activated, have, you know, very transformative orgasms, if you like, that other models of sexuality don't do. And then the question is, well, what's in it for the men? And all of these men I interviewed said, you know what? It is so great to know that, I mean, as Mike Luzzatto put it, men want to feel potent in connection. They said there's such a great sense of potency, if you like, in knowing that you're bringing a woman all of this pleasure. So I haven't yet run into a man who says this is not useful information. On the contrary.
The name of the book is Vagina, A New Biography by Naomi Wolf. It is published by Echo. Naomi Wolf, a great pleasure. I thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thank you.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. The show was recorded at the Radio Foundation in New York City. My thanks to their team. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.